This talk was given by Michael Yukon Grody at the Zen Center of New York City. Yukon is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. There were a bunch of new people for the beginning instruction. And I want to say thank you, especially to taking your Sunday morning and coming here and trying something new out. If this resonates with you, know that we're open for business. You can come and sit with us 6:30 in the mornings, and most mornings 6:30 in the evenings. If it doesn't resonate with you, wonderful, you checked off something else on your list, and find something that does. Find a path to walk on, because as we know, this world is pretty unstable. So it's great to have our feet touch the ground with some practice or another. So I call this talk To Blunder, because it's one of my champion things that I do. And I found this great poem that I really liked, that I resonate with, called Emerging by Stephen Dunn. And what I'll do is, as the talk goes along, I'll keep taking bits and pieces from this poem and turn it towards the practice that we do, the practice of Buddhism. So I was really, thank you, Stephen Dunn, for writing this and helping me write a talk. Emerging by Stephen Dunn. Let's say men and women begin as slime, and some of us crawl out of the sea and fall into circumstance fraught with danger and cannot survive, but do. Slithering into a cave where the stories evolve, first as pictures on the walls, then as grunts that turn into something like words. For years, though, biology reigns. Our bodies go this way or that. Our culinary wisdom is to eat more than get eaten. Our good sense is to follow a guess. Let's say sometimes the accidental is the beginning of possibility. We discover that when we're most afraid, when catastrophe looms, opportunities abound. We learn the power of slings and stones, and the best storyteller emerges from all of those wishing to explain. Let's say he knows we need someone to admire and says a hero is a person who blunders into an open cave, and that it takes courage to blunder. Let's say he also says something about the beauty of slime. His or her story lives for a while because of its memorable turns, its strange moral fervor, while the others, merely accurate and true, disappear. So we crawl out of the sea and fall into circumstance fraught with danger and cannot survive, but do. We do, because woven into this fabric of reality, there is a never-ending causal chain of events. And in that, we are constantly becoming. And we must remember that. We're constantly becoming. A process that never ends, and in that becoming, there is constant change. Constant turning towards who and what we are. Our good sense is to follow a guess. Perhaps that guess could be seen as developing wisdom. That good sense is to understand that we are completely and wholly dependent on each other. Our well-being depends on living a life that is either in harmony with one another, which means to be able to get yourself enough out of the way to see, feel, hear, sense someone else's becoming, and bear witness or to isolate and ignore the cries of the other and live in heartbreak, leading to our distance rather than our lovingness. If we are awake, the choice is always ours. Moment after moment after moment, it's always our choice. In this poem, let's say sometimes the accidental is the beginning of possibilities. In this practice of ours, perhaps we would say that there are no accidents, you know, just the beginning of possibilities. You know, I came to the monastery 34 years ago. That's half my life. I've been involved in this practice there. And as I grow old there and cranky, I come from, you know, California, and I was an ex-Berkeley hippie, drug-addled, lost, hyper-gay maniac, making most things a bad ending, unfortunately, and imploding my life in a very weird way. But I was looking for any possibility to turn. So for years, the biology reigns, our bodies go this way or that, while I just couldn't feel the ground beneath my feet. You know, I remember in those days going to, we'd go to astrologers. That's how we say it. We went to astrologers back then, and back in them thar days. And I remember this guy I went to, he looked at my chart and he said, well, you have this trine here and you have that moon here, and you were born at 5:01 in the morning. And God just said, you know, well, he throws you into the world and says, make it up as you go along. Well, we all make it up as we go along, bit by bit. We just forget. We need to remember that we're making this up as we go along. So I, you know, as I was making it up, weirdly enough, that's just what I was doing, singing gospel and selling drugs. And actually, we all make it up. And as we make it up, some of us have the kind of karma where we can feel the ground beneath our feet. And for others, it can be a game of lost and found. You know, upon meeting Daito Roshi, you know, the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery, he founded the place in 1980. He too looked to me like someone who had been through many realms himself, both hell realms and God realms, and had found a practice, and a very powerful life force was coming through him. You know, and he allowed me to, in seeing him and working, starting to work with him, it allowed me to see, it allowed me to stop spinning, and it gave me enough space and time to pause. And enough space to stop and consider, you know, to have a moment enough to become spacious enough to stop. The best storyteller emerges from all of those wishing to explain. So I found early on Thomas Merton, who was a great Trappist monk, and was able to really offer and verbalize the life of a monastic and what that was. So he turned me, helped turn me, Daito Roshi and Thomas Merton, towards the path. And he had also developed a relationship with Zen Buddhism himself before he died. The piece I wanted to share with you, it's remained for me so compelling and such a part of what we continue to attempt to unfold in a monastic life. And most folks that I'm talking to here, of course, aren't monastics, but they practice and they live in the world and study and sit here. And they rarely have a chance to hear what it might be like to turn inwards, towards this life. And I thought it might be helpful because you can take some of this and you can use it in the world. Because it's a way that it turns so clearly, and it's so different than what we're used to hearing. So this is the way Merton begins. Monasticism seems so much a thing of the past, a and so alien to technological society. And this is him writing in the 60s. The life of the monastic seems on many counts to be pointless, and these objections themselves dictate a reply. It is natural to argue that monastics are not so different after all, and to assert that they have a very definite role to play in the modern world, that they are part of the world, and that they are not useless at all. Frankly, these arguments are often misleading and unsatisfactory. To say that monastics are justified because they do work practice and because the monastery is really functioning in the world is often to compromise the real meaning of the monastic life. Actually, what matters about the monastery is precisely that it is radically different from the world. The apparent pointlessness of the monastery in the eyes of the world is exactly what gives it a real reason for existing. In a world of noise, confusion, and conflict, it is necessary that there be places of silence and inner discipline and peace. Not the peace of mere relaxation, but the peace of inner clarity and love based on monastic vows in a world of tension and breakdown. It is necessary for there to be people who seek to integrate their inner lives not by avoiding anguish and running away from problems, but by facing them in their naked reality and in their ordinariness. Let no one justify the monastery as a place from which anguish is utterly absent and in which people have no problems. This is a myth, and if you've ever been to the monastery, you'll see that that's not the case. Closely related to the other myth that religion itself disposes of all people's anxieties, faith itself implies a certain anguish. And it is a way of confronting inner suffering, not a magic formula for making all problems vanish. It is not by extraordinary spiritual adventures or by dramatic or heroic exploits that the monastic comes to term with life. The monastery teaches the monastics to take their own measure and to accept their ordinariness. In a word, it teaches them the truth about themselves, which is known as humility. As for functioning in the world, it is certainly true that the monastic, in a sense, functions in the world in terms of much of their activity. But this particular expression unfortunately suggests a kind of inner busyness and spiritual bustle that is quite alien to the monastic spirit. Monastics do not function in the world as much as they respond to the needs of the spirit of the world. They respond in accord with the imperative. Their activity is immeasurable. Monastic life is not quantitative. What counts is not the amount of activity and compassionate works, not the multitude and variety of ascetic practices, not the ascent of various degrees of holiness. What counts is not to count and not to be counted. Compassion seeks no justification outside of itself. Compassion is sufficient to itself, is pleasing in itself and for its own sake. Compassion is its own merit and its own reward. Compassion seeks no cause outside itself and no result other than itself. The fruit of compassion is compassion. And the reason for this all-sufficient character of compassion is that it comes from one's own realization of wisdom as one's source. It returns to oneself, and its end becomes wisdom itself. That's compassion. Monastics are valuable to the world precisely insofar as they are not part of it. And hence, it is futile to try and make them acceptable by giving them a place of honor in it. This is simply a meditation at on what one may frankly call the mystery of monastic life. That is to say that it attempts to penetrate the inner meaning of something that is essentially hidden, a spiritual reality that eludes clear explanation. You know, it has become more and more important for those of us at the monastery, and there are 11 monastics there now. So 99.9% of the practice is oriented towards people who live in the world. But it's so important to remember that our prison programs and our Beyond Fear of Differences groups and our environmental programs, these things are so important. But it seems to me so important that we don't forget what lies at the heart of our practice, which is renunciation and turning inward. You know, we learn to merge these things, but we can't forget that that's at the heart is turning inward. We learn the power of slings and stones, and in our practice, we would say that we learn the power of laying them down. Right? Agitation, turmoil affect human life, not only in personal and private ways, but also in the way we interact with each other socially. From the most ancient times, the world of ours has always been one of violent confrontations. So much conflict. The names, the places, and the instruments of destruction may change, but the forces behind them, the expressions of greed and hate, remain fairly constant. The Buddha's teachings emphasize personal liberation, but so many of his teachings emphasize loving kindness and compassion, on being gentle in speech, on harmlessness in action. It comes from his awareness of the violence and injustice that cripple human lives and in such cruel ways. Naomi Nye speaks of kindness in this way. I'll paraphrase her here. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrows, the other deepest thing. You must awake up with sorrow. You must speak it to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrow and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes any sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for. And then it goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So Stephen Dunn in his poem again. And the best storyteller emerges from all of those wishing to explain. Let's say he or she knows we need someone to admire, and says a hero is a person who blunders into an open cave. You know, the Buddha to millions and millions of people is just that person. He opened the gates of the palace and he blundered into the world, basically. You know, clueless. With nothing but the courage to not know. You know, taking the next step. His good sense to follow a guess and keep asking. Years of good teachings from teachers at that time, but ultimately unsatisfying. Ascetic practice to the extreme, coming close to death, taking sustenance, finding a tree and wholeheartedly finding his way to the Dharma. Thus, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, it's to be fully understood. Second truth, the truth of suffering's origin or craving, a constantly grasping. And at the heart of this practice is really all about letting go. It's constantly letting go. And when you do a bow, you're falling, you're letting go. You know, you're raising your hands above your ears and you're saying, you're humbling yourself and saying, yeah, I don't know everything after all. So you fall again. You know, it's the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You know, and you reinvigorate them in your life. And you take them to the heart of you. The third truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth truth, the truth of the path, is to be developed. So in the Pali Canon, the entire world system quakes and shakes, and a great light surpassing the radiance of the gods appears in the world. Then at the very end, we return from the glorious scene back to the prosaic human realm, you know, to behold the Buddha, briefly congratulating the ascetic Donadonna for gaining the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dharma. In one split second, the lamp of the doctrine has passed from master to disciple to begin his journey throughout India and across the world. Here, 2,501 years later, his story lives for a while because of its memorable turns, its strange moral fervor, while others merely accurate and true disappear. I would say in this case, that would be a profound understatement. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.